You're listening to
Potluck. And what is poppin', everybody? You're listening to the Good Pop Culture Club, episode 191. My name is Marvin Yue, and join me as always to talk about all the good pop that gets us through our days are my co-hosts, the once and future professional Asian American Just Jew, and our most professional of culture editors, Han Win. Hey guys, welcome back.
Marvin, it's Taurus season. It's almost May, the 1 month we exist. I double exist because that's also Mental Health Awareness Month.
Oh.
And I feel my crystals recharging. Add another Godzilla scream right here.
Is that good? Do you want your crystals recharged? I didn't know you were a crystals person, Jess. I'm learning something new.
Yes, we want the crystals. I'm not, but I went to Santa Fe and the vortexes. I don't know if you've ever been to that part of the country. They're very into vortexes. Which has something to do with energy. I didn't look too much into it. I'm not trying to get into some occult mess. But yes, as the kids say, the crystals are recharging.
Well, I guess I'm happy for you. Should I be happy for you or should I be worried?
It's good. Well, you know, Mercury is no longer in retrograde. So I don't know if y'all felt, you know, a shift in energy in a positive manner this week. You know, things... The weather in LA is finally kind of starting to get
warmer. I mean, we finally had a good sunny weekend, but it was like 55 degrees today. So, you know, still a little funky.
I'll take the gloomy days on the weekdays and the sunny days on the weekends. If like El Nino can like stick with that cycle, I am okay.
And Han, you're back after 2 weeks away from your trip to Thailand. How was that?
Yeah, Thailand was great. I did go for a work trip. I can now tell you that it was for the FX series coming up, Alien. Noah Hawley, who had adapted Fargo for the small screen, you know, and has had several seasons, successful seasons with that, is now turning his eye to the Alien franchise. It was something that was actually on his radar way before the pandemic. Obviously, got stopped because the pandemic is back up, and it is shooting in Thailand. I cannot talk any about the plot or anything like that. But it was fascinating to see production in Thailand because, of course, as maybe I have discussed before, I'm interested in a lot of TV shows that come out of there, including BL series. So I did kind of talk to people about that. I talked to some interpreters to become their friends. I checked out the one big TV studio that both manages artists and create TV shows. And so, yeah, it was a really good trip on the work side. I got a lot of interviews done. I was able to, you know, see some of the fun things. I definitely want to go back because it was a work trip. I basically only stayed in Bangkok, which is where it was. But also, like, April, it's still, I think, what they call monsoon season. So I'm someone who sweats when it's 65 degrees. There it was like 98 degrees plus extreme humidity. So every time I opened my app, they were like, feels like 112. So I definitely had to pack very strategically. I wore more dresses than not because I needed to feel free. I took many showers during the day. I did actually have to do laundry once because I sweat through too many things.
Oh, my God.
I did buy a few extra things because I knew that certain clothes were cheap. I try not to do the fast fashion stuff, but yes, I did buy some elephant pants because I had to.
You have to in your entire life.
Yeah. And so, you know, I did some of the touristy things. I did get to see some capybaras, which is cute. There was a cafe.
I did see a lot of capybaras in your Instagram stories.
Yeah. And I wish I totally forgot. Like the last day, I was so exhausted. I had some extra time before my flight. I should have gone and seen some like turtles, because one of the actors I talked to, they said there's a turtle sanctuary where tons of turtles come to you. And I was like, oh, that would have been great. But yeah, I actually was able to see a bunch. One of the fun things is if you go to Thailand, the easiest, besides prices being super, super, super cheap there, that means if you are not the type of person who wants to take public transportation, I am, but for the limited time I was there, I didn't have the time to do that because, you know, it always takes longer. So you can just get like their equivalent of a rideshare using an app called Grab. But Grab also gives you, delivers you food. So although I did grab taxis many places to, you know, I also several times took the Grab scooter. So they call it Grab Bike. And so I would climb on the back of one of those scooters and, you know, whiz through the traffic, which is really fun. It's definitely more fun if you're small like me, because you don't get too scared. Like there was one person in our group, because I was in a group of journalists, who had taken a bike, but he was like 6'3". And so he was just like, yeah, I kept thinking like my knees were going to get like knocked on the cars next to me. So it was really fun. It was not, that's not only faster and cheaper, but also like just a great way to kind of see a city on the ground level, because you kind of don't always look out from a taxi. Yeah. And also it was breezy that way. So I really enjoyed that. And oh, one more bonus is I did meet some international BL fans, because I'm part of a Discord server with some of them. And there happened to be three people from Germany there. And so we met up and had grilled pork, which was great.
Yeah.
And yeah, so it was a very short trip. Great adventure.
That sounds
so
fun.
It's nice to see the positive sides of social media every once in a while, since after living in the gutter for so long, you know?
Well, I think how, you know, some people talk about like, oh, K-pop or BTS helped me become friends with people all over the world. This is my BTS, or this is my K-pop. So, and I've definitely made friends there. Like, we're not like BFFs, but like, you know, I think it was actually fun and easy and not awkward at all. Or maybe I'm just not awkward in those situations to meet three total strangers and eat food. And talk BL. So yeah, it was a really cool time. I definitely want to go back and maybe like see other places, not just Bangkok.
Did you run into anybody from the White Lotus set?
I tried to. I literally reached out to HBO and was like, by the way, we couldn't get it together. I tried to do something, because even though I was like, it doesn't matter if you're not shooting and there are no actors for me to talk to. I'm not looking for scoops. I was like, I just want to know something about production. So like, if you want me to talk to a hotel coordinator or someone who's, you know, looking at the decorations or even the flowers, whatever it is, I was like, I will talk to them. But they're like, this is great information, but we couldn't do it. So I was like,
We know they always shoot at like a Four Seasons. So you should have just gone to the Four Seasons Bangkok, like, been like, Mike, Mike.
There were, of course, Netflix Thai productions that I tried to get an interview together. But because I was there right before their New Year's festival, Songkran, most of them were either busy or traveling or whatever. So I tried to interview the director, and that didn't work out too, for Ready, Set, Love, in fact. But I tried to do extra work while I was there, did not do it. Oh, well, I gave it my best effort, because I really did want to make it like worthwhile since I was there. But so.
And this was for Alien, which has nothing to do with Ripley, because Ripley is not an Alien show.
We were dumb and we're like, oh, yeah, Han's there for Ripley, right? Like the Alien show. And then I saw Ripley on Max. I'm like, this doesn't, like, what is the hot priest doing in there?
Andrew Scott. Yeah, every time I see the name Ripley, even though I know it's not Alien, I keep thinking of Ripley from Alien. So it gets me every time. And I was actually excited at first too, because I thought Ripley was like going to be a younger version of Ripley, of Sigourney Weaver, but no. But yes, it's Alien. We actually don't know the title yet. It might just end up being Alien, just like Fargo ended up being Fargo.
Yeah, well, glad you're back, Han. On this episode of Good Pop, we are discussing the new Dev Patel action thriller Monkey Man, which is also Dev Patel's directorial debut. But before we get to that, let's find out what other pop culture has been getting us through this week. Jess, let's start with you. What's popping?
All right, I'm going to make this quick. This is my matchstick pitch. Is your brain a little spicy? Are you a little neuroatypical?
Yeah.
Do you like cats?
Yes.
Then you should play A Little to the Left, which is the game I was obsessed with this last week. It is literally a puzzle organizing game where you are given a series of random things to organize. It could be pencils. It could be pasta shapes. It could be jars of pickles, plants. You just kind of have to figure out like how to organize them. And sometimes there's more than one way. Very, it is like a, like, you know when like dogs are anxious and you have to get them a lick mat? It's like my lick mat. Like, I've never been more calmed and soothed. But yeah, I think it, this is really for like the girls with a little, like, and the guys with a little tism, if you know what I mean.
Sure.
Because the whole game is recognizing patterns that may or may not exist. And the cherry on top, and this is definitely, I think, something you would appreciate, Han. A cat comes up and fucks up your shit on some levels.
Oh,
and
that's
part
of
the game. And the cat looms large, you know, like, like, so it's very, it's, there's no words. The sound design is very soothing and calming. I think the graphics are very cute and very, calming and like consistent. For me, like, I'm really picky with the how my games look. Like, nothing's like a bigger pet peeve in terms of games than when like the aesthetics don't match, like the character design and the background don't match, or like, you know, like something doesn't match. It is all very consistently rendered, very beautiful, and it is like a lick mat for your brain. I would highly recommend it. It's available on Steam. You could bang it out like in one sitting like I did, or you can kind of like parse it out and kind of take it at a calmer rate. And then, you know, once you finish the main chapters, you can, they also have like a daily, they call it a daily tidy. So I feel like this is for people who can't fucking seem to clean in real life, but they would enjoy this cleaning game. So a little to the left, I would definitely check it out. I would love to hear what your thoughts are on this, Han, because I think it's gonna be hit or miss for you.
I will do this because, as I think I've mentioned before, in the early days of our podcast, I did play at Animal Crossing, but then it got too stressful for me because I started hoarding, and then the chores, I couldn't keep up with the chores, so I was just like, oh, I think I'm gonna have to quit because it's stressing me out. So this one sounds very nice.
Yeah,
actually,
it's like very finite. Like, you know, it's just enough stimulation. The levels are just hard enough. It's when you get it correct that like a little like dopamine sound plays. It's very rewarding.
I mean,
Marvin,
I feel like with Han, all you need to do is tell her that there's a cat in it.
There's a cat.
Instant sale.
There's a cat.
Yeah, there are. The most stressful part of the game is there is one level where the cat like keeps fucking your shit up, so you actually have to like swat the cat's little paw to get him to stop, which is cute. And also, but that was very stressful for me because like I'm very bad with game controls. Like, I did not grow up playing consoles. I did not have like gamer cousins, you know, so like I'm very bad with controls. So like me actually just trying to like move the joystick fast enough to like actually hit this cat in time, not hit, like gently tap this cat's paw, was like stressing me out. I had to hand that to my husband to like do that for me. But everything else, and he's like looking at me, he's like, what, like how are you? Here's another great litmus test. Apparently this is on TikTok, so of course take everything with a grain of salt. No one's real on there, but you know, there's apparently a question about like they ask in determining like your neurotypicalness, and one of them was like, oh, like what do 2 and 7 have in common?
Interesting. Okay, I will definitely check that.
Yeah. The simple answer is they're both numbers. My ass is standing there being like, well, they both have these like cantilever, like top heavy.
I was also going over like this, the shape of the numbers.
The shape and like the balance. Yeah, they have like a diagonal, like vertical line. Yeah, so Marvin, maybe you should play this game too and tell me how it makes you feel.
I mean, my wife does have the game on her Switch because it's also available on Switch. And I think her issue with it is sometimes the solutions don't fall in line with her logic on how she would organize things. So I think part of the game is also figuring out what the game wants from you. But I do know there is DLC coming soon too, so you'll have more to play.
Ooh. Oh, great. I can't wait. Cause I've never been more mentally stimulated and like spent in a good way than playing this game over this weekend. It was like, it's faster acting than Lexapro. That's all I have to say about that. Bahan, what's popping with you?
I actually caught up on a few things, but one thing in particular I was going to check out because everyone was talking about it was Bluey. For those of you who don't know, Bluey is a preschooler TV show, cartoon, That's made in Australia. It was basically sort of their answer to Peppa Pig, which is a British, you know, cartoon that's cute with pigs and sometimes a little irreverent. So I would say in some respects it has that sort of vibe. So Bluey is about a family of blue heelers. That's a type of Australian cattle dog. The way they're drawn, it's very rectangular. And Bluey and her dad, Bandit, are actually blue in color. The mom, Chili, and the younger sister, Bingo, are I guess, considered red or orange. And the deal is, one of the reasons why it became a big deal is it sort of still had that crossover appeal to adults, not only just because it has that little irreverence, as I was mentioning, when it comes to these young plot lines, but they actually do address serious adult things, too, in such a way that we totally as adults understand what's going on, but maybe kids don't. And so there have been a number of times people say that Bluey makes them cry. And in particular, it was season 3 has already almost ended, but then Bluey came back with a new episode. It was a special. And this is when I started hearing about it a lot more. The special is called The Sign. So if those of you in the United States who want to watch it, it's on Disney Plus. And then so you just go to the end of season 3 and look, there's The Sign, and then there's an extra episode I'll talk about in a bit. But The Sign is a 30-minute special, because usually they're about, you know, like 12-minute episodes. And I was like, it's good so far. And I had watched Bluey before because, you know, it's been a big phenomenon, like, worldwide. And it's a very satisfying show. The father, Bandit, is very fun. I think the best thing I think I like about the show is, besides the positive portrayals of the adult, is the dad, Bandit, actually gets really into playing with the daughters as far as doing all of their imaginative games. And he even brings up some and himself. And so he's kind of known as, you know, the parent who plays. So we see that here. The reason why it's called The Sign is because dad is going to try to move to another city for a new job. And so they have to sell their house, which is, you know, very disconcerting for Bluey. Bingo doesn't quite get it. And so, of course, it goes through all of those themes that we all understand about moving, especially when you're a kid and not understanding what that means or what changes will happen. It's still very, very funny. And God damn it, if it didn't make me cry by the end, there's a sequence with a song that they beautifully edited. And I was just like, what the fuck is, like, Bluey, what are you doing to me? I will say I also got another, you know, I also got verklempt in the next episode. Episode is called Surprise, for a reason. And I think the other thing is that it also appeals. Well, this season has been creating some discourse. Is there have been a few flash forwards that are very intriguing, and people are wondering, first of all, what that means, because people are like, "Why?" It seemed like The Sign meant that was the end of this. Of Bluey altogether, but that some people are like, so there's a lot of theories. You have to go to Reddit. Their theory.
Going to Reddit for the Bluey conspiracy takes.
Oh, there's so many conspiracies.
Oh,
so
my God.
Some are, the biggest theory is like they are going to continue with Bluey, which that has been confirmed, but that it will fast forward until Bluey is an adult. And
what?
And one of the reasons why is we have seen Bluey as an adult, and here's a crazier thing. We've seen one of Bluey's kids, and based on how this kid looks, there are theories about who the baby daddy is.
This is, we're talking about a children's show. Oh,
these are
juicy.
These are.
I might have to watch this now.
These are details that mainly adults will catch. By the way, we will be. So there are people freeze framing, looking at pictures on walls, comparing kitchens from one episode to another, being like, "This is a flash forward."
Wait, or whatever. So you're telling me that there are people like there are like Screen Rant articles about what you may have missed or what does the ending mean for Bluey? Like those
Google
articles
it.
Going around.
Google it now and you will see them all explaining some. They will either have the word surprise or The Sign in there, usually because those are the last two episodes that just aired. So, yes, it's been fun. It's been really fun just to see the people get kind of like worked up about it, because like I don't really have a dog in this fight. But yeah, it's, but I still enjoy it, and I think it's just super, super well done. So yeah, that was my Bluey. It's very exciting. There's more Bluey to come. I'm excited to see what actually happens. Will it be a time jump or not? Anyway,
I love that there's
dun, dun, dun. There's conspiracy around a children's show. Love it.
Yeah, so that is mine. What's popping with you, Marvin?
Yeah, so I've been watching the new Fallout series on Amazon Prime, and man, I really like it. So Fallout on Amazon is the live-action adaptation of the video game series Fallout by Bethesda Studios, produced by Jonathan Nolan and Lisa Joy, who were the team behind the Westworld series on HBO. I guess, before we get started, are you guys familiar with the Fallout series at all?
Not really. I just know it's a video game.
Yeah, same.
The game and the show both have, it's interesting because it has a very, like, the basics is it's set in the post-apocalyptic world after nuclear war has devastated the world. But it goes deeper than that. It's actually a pretty high concept premise. So it takes place in an alternate history version of the US where the future of the 1950s has become reality. So like a retro future based on the sci-fi of the 1950s, right? And so, you know, atomic energy has been harnessed, but resource scarcity still leads to war. One of the opening lines of every single Fallout game is war never changes. And basically, nuclear war breaks out between America, Russia, and China in 2077. And a lucky few people were able to survive in giant shelters called vaults to wait out the fallout and to resettle humanity in the future. So the show picks up 200 years after the nuclear apocalypse and follows the adventures of three survivors as they go out into the wasteland. So the main character we follow is Lucy, played by Ella Purnell, who from Yellow Jackets. She grew up in Vault 33, which is located beneath what used to be Santa Monica. And so her father, played by Kyle MacLachlan, is abducted when her vault is attacked by raiders. And so she sets out into the wasteland to find him, which is a pretty standard Fallout plot. Like most of the characters you play in the games is a vault dweller who, because of one reason or another, sets out into the wasteland to find a MacGuffin. She's a lot of fun as someone who grew up relatively privileged in safety and was raised in gosh howdy Americana, believes in meritocracy and the good in people. And throughout the series, you know, that worldview comes into violent conflict with what she has to do in order to, you know, survive in this violent wasteland that she finds herself in. And one thing that I really thought was funny, and I don't know if this was intentional or not, but her full name is Lucy McClane. And just like Bruce Willis's John McClane in the Die Hard movies, throughout the series, she gets just more and more disheveled.
I love that. Mm-hmm.
Another main character that we follow is Aaron Milton's Maximus, who is a squire of the Brotherhood of Steel, which is like a militarized monastic order patrolling the wastes in power armor, whose mission is to search for lost technologies from before the war for quote-unquote safekeeping, because they're the only ones they trust to handle technology. His character is someone who is also naive, but in a different way. He was raised, you know, after the bombs fell, after civilization collapsed. And so it's a really cool juxtaposition to see Lucy's character, who was raised essentially in the old ways, and his character, who was raised in the wasteland where survival is the number one priority. And finally, our third POV character, of course, is the breakout character of the series, the ghoul played by the great Walton Goggins.
Walton Goggins.
Yeah. He's the type of actor, like, much like Nick Cage, like, he makes anything he's in better just by being in it. And he's been on a lot of things, like The Righteous Gemstones, Justified, The Shield, of course, Sons of Anarchy. And he's great in all of them. And he definitely kills it in this role. So he plays the ghoul, who is a bounty hunter, who's also a ghoul. So like a ghoul in the Fallout series is a human who has become mutated through exposure to radiation. And as a result, takes on a very, like, essentially they look like the Red Skull from the Captain America movie. Leathery skin, no nose, kind of just looks like a walking skull, very zombie-like. But as a trade-off of becoming, you know, deformed, they also gain the ability to live for a long time. And Walton Goggins' character, the ghoul, has lived for a really long time. Like, his character is over 200 years old, and he actually was around before the bombs fell, which plays into his storyline as well. So he's had like 200 years to let the post-apocalypse change him and lose all his faith in, you know, humanity and being a righteous person. And so we find him now as like a grizzled, cynical bounty hunter out to capture his quarry, which happens to be the same MacGuffin that the other two main characters are also after. We also learn a lot about his life before the bombs fell, where he was a Hollywood actor who slowly begins to uncover like the corporate motivations behind the nuclear war, which is a lot of fun too. And even though he's like this irradiated skull with no nose, he still looks great. The internet still wants to fuck him.
Yeah, he got Riz. He got Riz.
Yeah.
He could get it still, even with the no nose. Like, it's fine, you know? Something about the confidence.
Yeah, I mean, every single scene he is in is great. And he's just chewing, gnawing on every single scene and having just a great time doing it. And it just really reminds you of just how great of an actor he is.
And I mean, there are shows that I don't even really love that much and I will watch because he's in. So like The Unicorn, I don't know if anyone remembers that on CBS. No, yes, no. But yeah, he's also just a cool guy. I've definitely met Walton Goggins in person. So I think there's a lot of like, goodwill behind the scenes, and he's also just a fantastic actor. So.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, this sounds good. It just sounds like a lot, so I might just have to watch it. I can't binge it.
I mean, it is quite bingeable and is a ton of fun. I was actually pretty skeptical going into the show initially because the Fallout series has like a really unique vibe that really works for the video game, right? It's telling a story with the trappings of American exceptionalism.
Yeah.
But also the consequences of that exceptionalism, of the military-industrial complex, of corporate greed, and how that's going to destroy the world, while also being an oftentimes violent video game. And I feel like the show nailed it. It walks that tightrope confidently, which is not something that I was entirely expecting.
I mean, Prime Video also has The Boys, so I feel like this is the streaming service for that type of stuff. If you, not to compare them thematically or anything, but as far as adaptations go, do you think Last of Us or this did it better, truer to their video game?
Well, the thing is, this is an original story. The Last of Us is like a shot-for-shot remake of the video game because the game was designed to be cinematic. Mm-hmm. Fallout,
That's true. It's a different
narrative. Yeah.
Yeah. Fallout shows it's a completely fresh narrative, taking place in the same world but different time period. And it does a really good job of like, you know, the three main characters are kind of different ways people play their characters, right? Like Lucy is the person who tries to do the right thing, tries to, you know, doing the pacifist run, trying to talk people down, stop shooting. And the ghoul is just like, shoot first and justify the means. Like, you're in my way, so I'm going to, you know, shoot you and get what I want. And then, you know, Maximus is kind of just in between somehow.
I think it's also interesting that you get yet another, I think, theme by Ramin Djawadi, because he did Game of Thrones, he did Westworld. So we recently saw he did Three Body Problem because of the makers of Game of Thrones. And here from Westworld, he came on to this project.
Yeah, I mean, I do hope this show maintains its quality because, you know, Westworld started off great. And then I feel like they kind of lost the thread of what they wanted to do with it. It does help that this world is already built. And so they just have to play in it. Hopefully that'll keep things on track. And this show seems much less up its own butt as Westworld is because it does have a sense of humor, which is great too. Fallout on Amazon Prime. Streaming now if you're looking for a show to binge over the weekend. Definitely check it out. I had a ton of fun watching this show. But yeah, that's what's popping for this week. But before we get to Monkey Man, let's check in with Top Chef in our podcast within the podcast Go Asian. We have 2 weeks to check in on. I don't want to linger too long since we're running a little long this week. But man, what a roller coaster ride for our Asians in Top Chef season 21. Really quickly, episode 4, the Frank Lloyd Wright Duality Architecture Team Challenge. I really like this. I really like when they try to.
I love
mix
this
in.
Shit. Yeah. Other art forms. You know me. I'm a whore for Frank Lloyd Wright.
Yep.
But man, how embarrassing is it when the judges have to come yell at you for not cooking good enough?
Oh, I was so judgy. I was like, they deserve
bring your
that.
Fucking A game, fam. Like, what is up? Like, these challenges usually inspire a lot of creativity and like some great stuff. I'm like, what the fuck, guys?
Yeah, only one team far and away understood the brief, basically. So,
yeah.
Yeah, they deserve that.
Yeah, Rasika and Danny are on top. I'm going to include Danny in our Go Asian lineup because West Asia technically still part of Asia. So, but yeah, they were the only ones who kind of brought it, right? Everyone else is essentially playing it safe, which is really sad. We ended with Kalima and Amanda being...
Buddha has to come and be like, you better cook to win?
Yeah, that's shaming. I have to say, Rasika, ever since the pretzel dessert, continues to be my favorite because she is ultimately very creative, but also very true to her flavor profile roots and just does really interesting things.
And the important thing is she's been able to pull it off, right? We've seen plenty of people with like ambitions, like Kenny. Like he definitely was trying to bring in Vietnamese flavors and techniques, but just couldn't pull it together. Rasika has great ideas and is able to pull it off, which is great. It means that it's a good sign of her going far in the competition if she can just make it past the hurdle that is Restaurant Wars, right? But yeah, this is the episode where Kalima and Amanda ends up being the chefs eliminated because it was a double elimination. Oh. And they get eliminated in the most classic Top Chef team challenge pitfalls, which is not talking to each other and treating a team competition as an individual challenge.
It was so painful. Oh my God. Like, and also their concept was just not good at all. I was like, I still don't understand it. They didn't know what they were doing. They deserve.
It was embarrassing. Yes.
Yeah.
Like the crust. You fucked up the crust. You guys are snipping at each other. Yeah. Oh my God. It was not a good showing.
I mean, they were bad from the start together.
Yeah. And then I guess moving on to the next episode, we start off with a sauce quickfire in honor of a cafeteria chef from the University of Wisconsin, who I guess was one of the first black cafeteria chefs to have his own cookbook. Each chef is assigned a sauce to pair with a dish. And Charlie ends up winning with his Creole sauce, which felt a little unfair. Right? That's kind of like right in his wheelhouse. But unfortunately, quickfires this season do not come with immunity. And so while Charlie won the quickfire, he ends up losing the elimination challenge, which was a supper club challenge, which I guess is a Midwest Wisconsin thing featuring multiple courses, a relish dish, a chicken dish, a fish dish, a steak dish, and a dessert. I don't know. Is this something you guys would want to try?
I would definitely attend it. Yeah.
I still don't really know what it is. Yeah. But yeah, like if you want to feed me, that sounds good. I would love a very hearty Midwestern meal. Mm-hmm. I would love a pickle plate. I love pickles.
Yeah.
Safe space. I still don't really understand how they work. So
agreed. It doesn't seem the same as any other group preset meal that I can understand. But I think it might just because it is a Midwestern thing. So I've never experienced a supper club meal.
Well, our Asians in this episode placed squarely in the middle of the pack. Dan, our resident white guy who cooks Asian food, ends up winning with his chicken liver mousse relish plate. We did get a little bit of drama where Danny ends up losing a ton of his ingredients in order to make budget for Laura's four leches cake that ended up not being good anyways.
Not worth the four leches. I'm also like, it's on you for not saying shit and letting her do that and a drink. I'm like, you should have said something. Yeah. So... she goes both ways. She could have been a little more aware and been a better team player, and they could have spoken up and been like, we're not letting you do that. You have to change your menu.
I mean, they're the Midwest. Adapt. You gotta be Wisconsin
Midwest
nice.
Right? Nice. Wisconsin nice, that's very true. But only like one of them's from Wisconsin, so...
And yeah, that brings us to our recap of Last Chance Kitchen. And surprise, surprise, Top Chef taketh away, Top Chef giveth back. As of last episode, we were down to two Asians left. And at the end of Last Chance Kitchen, we are back up to four. Both Su-on, bonus agent Su-on, and Kalima make it back into the competition proper.
And by back, I know you've probably discussed it before, but most people haven't seen Su-on because he's been only at Last Chance Kitchen. So this will be, I'm excited for everyone to meet him.
What are our thoughts?
What weird psychological curveball it will throw.
To meet him in his red pants.
I feel like obviously he hasn't been in the competition proper, so we don't see how he acts in full-on Top Chef pressure. But I feel like
He's been bringing
He's been doing this. He's been cooking the food the judges wish they were having in the regular competition.
Yes.
Right.
Yes,
so definitely yes. Like having someone else with his like pedigree and caliber in the competition will definitely shake things up. I feel like he can give Rasika a run for the top Asian money. Right.
Yeah. I hope so.
But yeah, we're back up to four. Top Chef, Go Asian still going strong. We'll see how it goes. But yeah, that'll do it for this week's Go Asian recap of Top Chef season 21. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're talking about Dev Patel's Monkey Man. Stick around.
Hello, I'm Phil Yu, and I'm the host of All the Asians on Star Trek, the podcast in which I interview all the Asians on Star Trek. I'm talking to actors, writers, directors, stunt people, background extras. You know, all the Asians on Star Trek. Find out more at alltheasiansonstartrek.com. Part of the Potluck Podcast Collective. Live long and prosper.
Hey, Brian, did you go to Saturday school as a kid?
I sure did. Did you?
Totally.
Well, at our podcast, Saturday School, we don't teach a language, but we pass along the culture that we do know.
And that's Asian American pop culture.
Ada's a journalist, and I'm a professor and film festival programmer.
We've watched a lot of great Asian American movies, and we want you to watch them too. Come listen to us as we look back at the pioneering films that have led us to today.
And welcome back to the Good Pop Culture Club. On this episode, we are discussing Monkey Man, the new action thriller film, which is also Dev Patel's directorial debut that he also co-wrote with Paul Anguinoela, John Culley, and Jordan Peele. Jordan Peele, who was also a co-producer along with Dev Patel. So definitely a lot of collaboration going on this film. The film stars Dev Patel as a man on a mission to take revenge on a corrupt police chief and the guru that he works for the murder of his mother and the displacement of his people. So yeah, let's get started. What did we think of Monkey Man?
I had a great ass time. Oh my God. I don't know. I heard it was like pretty, I heard it was good, but, and disclaimer, I do not know Dev Patel. I am so proud of him.
Yes.
I think it's a really ambitious first project. I think he mostly pulls it off. Mm-hmm. You know, I think there's some deeper questions about some of the choices he makes or some of the story. And honestly, if he should even be the one, like what it means for him to be doing this story as a Indian British man, right? But from like a pure action standpoint, I think also knowing the story of how little money he had to pull this off, I was very impressed, and I thought it was a nice homage to a lot of the action franchises we love, but still had its own, whether by choice or by logistical need, had a very distinct voice.
Yeah, you know how most first attempts are like very talky films. This was not it. This was, when you talk about ambitious, it was like there's action, there's lore, there's flashbacks, there's like emotional parts. They hit a lot of tropes that I enjoy. So the stuff that I think that worked the best were the action-y things, the John Wick-y, the John Wick-y type things. It was the stuff in the trailer, right? That very wisely put out there, and so I enjoyed all that a lot. The rest of it, I don't want to say I didn't enjoy, but I think for me, there were a few pacing problems and a few things where maybe had I been of a different background, I maybe would have understood more. So I felt like I was missing some context. And just because I'm Han, I did get motion sick for certain things. So
yes,
I think his one of the things about his direction is he likes to be really close up to people or scenes. And so when action happens, even if it's moving from one end of the room to another, if the camera's that close, it's just kind of like, what do I focus on? So there were times I actually had to just look away from the screen. But yeah, overall, I'm impressed. It felt a little mixed to me, but still very good.
It's interesting that you mentioned that most directorial debuts are like talkies, right? Because I feel like this film is at its best when it's not talking. It's a great action film when action is happening.
Yeah.
And an okay film about revenge and society's downtrodden when action is not happening. I mean, it definitely wasn't the, like, I was expecting Dev Patel as John Wick, and it wasn't exactly that. But at the end of the day, I would still love to see more Dev Patel in action films. I think he has solidified his cred as someone who can pull off, much like Keanu Reeves in John Wick or The Matrix, someone who can be the guy for these films.
Yeah, or maybe collaborate with someone who can, you know, maybe even out some of the other elements. And because I still think this has a lot of great stuff in it.
Yeah, I think the parts where he does, there's some really, really great sequences. And I think he's really good at building the world out. Like, I think all the, you know, the first few sequences when we kind of get the lay of, like, the wallet passing and kind of, like, the whole, like, plot to get this woman's wallet, I think was, like, very charming. You know, his infiltration of the club and, like, his plan to, like, get himself access and just kind of seeing how this character, like, how he shows how this character's brain is working. I thought those were really successful scenes. But, like, I would say that's majority in the first half, right, of the movie. And then there is, like, a midway point where it becomes about something else. It's still more action-y, but it kind of gets a little more spiritual, gets a little more philosophical, gets more political. And that's where I think some of the movie's lack of focus is most present, because they're really big themes, right? And again, a lot of the nuance went over my head, but it's also like, oh, we talking about, like, current Indian politics. There's like, there's just, like, a lot of themes, character arcs going around, and I don't know if the plane has landed in all of them in the time we have. And I feel like it would have been nice to, like, maybe eschew some of those to spend more time with some of those other buckets. Yeah.
It really does feel like it's, you know, two separate movies. Right? Like, the first half of the movie is about Dev's character working really hard to put himself in the position to achieve his revenge. You know, he's manipulating people and events. He's acquiring equipment, all for his singular goal. And then somewhere around the halfway part of the movie, the vibes shift, right? He gets introduced to a whole new community, and the story takes on more, like, spiritual tones about finding purpose, which are also interesting things to explore in a revenge story. But I kind of wish it was more integrated into the plot as a whole, right? Like, the way that they're introduced is very deus ex machina-y, and their role in the story is more functional than anything, right? They're there to explain the spiritual themes through exposition, and they're there to get Dev's character from point A to point B between the first and third acts.
Yeah.
They do get some pretty awesome fucking moments, though. Which, and my, you didn't catch the Chekhov's mention of the trans community in the, you know, first 5 minutes of the film, Marvin?
Yes, on TV. Because I remember clocking that and I was like, interesting addition there. There were, like, two things from that broadcast.
Yeah, I think we all kind of caught that part, but it still felt a little like a sloppy way to provide exposition, right? To explain to us this community that we're going to meet later on. And I get that the film is trying to explore, you know, the marginalized communities of modern India, but something about that part just seemed a little too on the nose, right?
Yeah, no, I do think he tried to tackle a lot of things. And it's very possible, actually, you're right, that maybe that extra broadcast line was added for us, because even calling the characters transgender is not entirely accurate. Because I had to look up some stuff because I was like, I think there's something else going on here. And they're actually Hijra. I'm not sure if I'm saying that right, but it's sort of an umbrella term that that refers to the third gender of South Asians. And so that includes transgender, intersex, eunuchs, and other people who are not the usual binary, I guess, cisgender. So that also maybe helped me understand why the people who portrayed them were not all transgender. Because I think a lot of the actual people in life who are Hijra may not actually go through any sort of hormone therapy or anything like that, but they just live their gender life. So I wish definitely that if you know, the inclusion of them had maybe tiny bit more context. I don't know if it needed it for the enjoyment part of what they got to do later. But for me, as far as the significance of maybe them helping him or him getting being embraced into that community, there was, like, a lot of questions I had that I kind of wanted to know more about.
Yeah, I mean, not to, like, dwell on the structure of the script. I just feel like they if they were going to be such a big part of his, like, what he's fighting for, I would have preferred that to have been the case the entire film. You know, because there's a lot of history that this goes to. There's a whole, like, there's a whole second act flashback that goes, like, this film does a really good job of, like, giving us bits and pieces of why this character wants revenge and does a really good job of doing a lot with the little that we get. And then in the second act decides, you know what, we're just going to tell you the whole story anyways. You know?
That is true. I feel like, that's what I mean, like, it felt like there was, like, this, you know, the main movie is, like, this straight line, and then there's all these, like, really other cool, interesting bits that are intersecting it, but then our intersection in that time is, like, so short, right? Like, he introduces a lot of cool ideas, concepts, generally the script, yeah. I think. Mm-hmm. You know, like, honestly, I'm, like, was cut, other than being able to get some very cool action scenes and, like, the whole, like, visual concept of, like, the monkey man in, I was like, oh, did these fight scenes really matter other than as a mechanism to get him money, like just kind of as, like, a story plot device to get him money? And then I was like, oh, like, you know, I was like, oh, he's bleaching, you know, Chekhov's bleach, he's bleaching his monkey mask, and then he just, like, takes it off. I'm like, oh, okay, like, I appreciate that because I do want to see Dev Patel's beautiful face fighting. Uh-huh. And but then I was like, oh, like, you gave us that cool moment, and okay, we're not going to quite wrap up that bow. So, yeah, there's a little rough edges, but then I do think it's quite forgivable. You kind of forgive it when, like, you know, he takes off the mask, and then he has this really great scene where he just moves into that kitchen and just uses, like, all these different appliances to, like, just to, like, biff all the henchmen, right? Mm-hmm. I'm just like, this is great. I audibly went, like, ooh, quite a few times in the action scenes. The elevator, I was like, wow, he really went there.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, there are a lot of great fights. And you know, Han talked about how some of the fights you're really up close, but there's also some fight scenes where it's just like just one long take. And I'm sure they, like, snuck in some, like, stealth cuts here and there. Mm-hmm. But, like, he does a lot. There's a lot of fighting, a lot of different ways to shoot the fighting. There's a really great mirror fight scene that was just way cooler than what we got from Silent Night, right?
Yeah, I also thought of Silent Night, and I'm like, oh, this is
so much better.
So much better.
And the film is also, it has funny moments, right? There's some lines that really made me chuckle, like there's a line where he's trying to buy a gun and the guy tells him this is John Wick's gun but made in China.
Yeah.
And so there's a scene that was spoiled in the trailer, but, like, he's, you know, trying to run away and he tries to jump through a window like you do in an action film, and just, like, it stopped because the window's too thick. Even though I knew that was coming, I still laughed.
Or it's, like, bulletproof, you know, like, like, it's sealed shut. Yeah. And you know, there's, like, great characters, like Alfonso, kind of like the henchman buddy, like gangster buddy he picks up is a hoot. Queenie, the manager of, like, the club brothel that he has to infiltrate is a hoot.
There's even the John Wick dog, although this one doesn't die.
When the dog came in, I was like, I turned to my husband, I'm like, he's gonna teach this bitch how to bring the gun.
Yep.
And I was like, I fucking love this. I was like, do I think my dog would help me do this? I don't think my dog would do it. But yeah, glad the dog makes it out unscathed. Spoiler alert. He knows where to draw the line.
He learned the John Wick lesson. Come on.
He learned the John Wick. Yeah. And there's a lot of I see a lot of John Wick influence. I see a lot of, even, you know, Danny Boyle, right? Like, Danny Boyle also has this, like, very kinetic energy in his films. A lot of, like, you know, a lot of Dutch angles.
Yes, a
which
lot.
He did not piss me off, though.
Speaking of Judge John McClane, the sign of a true action star is if they can still look hot when they're bloody and beaten up.
He's so hot.
Yeah, and if we're going to compare it to, let's say, Die Hard, being a Christmas film, this is a Diwali film.
It is a Diwali film. Yeah.
I understand that beauty standards are different, and I understand for this movie to work, you know, he kind of has to be a nobody. But I had a very hard time. Yeah. The most unbelievable thing was me. I was like, this, like, how tall is he? Like 6'2", 6'3"? You're telling me this beautiful 6'2" man walking through the slums of India, or, like, working in, like, you know, like, working in a club, or even just, like, when he's on the lam, like, standing in a political rally, like, wouldn't attract attention? Like, are the standards that different? Because he's, you know, there's certain scenes where he's shirtless, which I really appreciated.
just how hard did you pop during that scene where he literally rips off, like rips his tank top open to show off his...
So in that first scene, right? Like the first scene, he rips off his shirt, but it's like this like, you know, psychedelic like drug trip where he's like, then it starts splitting. I did not even notice the like psychedelic splitting until like like his chest was gaping open. I was just like, I literally went like, ooh. And then I was like, oh, sorry, that's not the point of this scene. We are going through a trip through his trauma. Okay. And then later we get the actual like gratuitous, like, okay, thank you for for taking off your shirt. That's what we want. That's what the girlies wanted. And that they make that a moment in the movie as well. Really, we're bearing the lead. Like, just it's Dev Patel. Like, he's so charming. He's actually less charming in this movie than he usually is, because he didn't give himself the note to yearn.
Yeah.
You know, as we've said on this podcast before, and like other, you know, films he's done, like David Copperfield, Green Knight, Slumdog. He is an A plus yearner. Like that face when he's like, we get a sense of that with, you know, some of his trauma with his mother, but like we're not getting the full like effect. I think he held back on that.
Yeah.
Because he's like, you know, yeah.
Because he was revengey, you know, and I guess
he's revengey.
Yeah, yeah. So he wasn't soft in the usual yearning way.
Yes. Which I did miss a little bit. And I feel like he could have given us a little bone in the end, because you know, as much as I think I have mixed feelings about the end.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But I can't like deny that, like, oh, like in most revenge films, like, you know, once even though the revenge is completed, it's just like, oh, it's like, for what did that bring back what you wanted? Did that fill the hole? It's kind of like, you know, that's kind of the overarching thematic question of revenge plots films. And I was just like, yeah, you could have, I would have liked a little more yearning there, Dev Patel, because you're so good at it.
Yeah.
Sometimes people deserve to die.
Oh, no, 100% they all deserve to die, because, you know, he really constructed some, like, type A, like, villains, right? Mm-hmm. Like, archetypal villains, like, terrible men, both, like, the goons and the henchmen, and this like, very corrupt world. Like again, I think he built, like, these, like, action trope world characters out very well. We 100% get it. After the whole flashback, I'm just like, this bitch better die the most vicious, terrible death. And he, you know, he really does.
They do a good job with some of the deaths, I have to say.
Mm-hmm. It's very brutal.
Where I would also, again, maybe like a little bit more context or something would have been, or maybe it's just a bonus for if you have the right background, is, you know, Monkey Man is, I think it's actually, you know, kind of based on Hanuman, so monkey god. And I wondered, since I don't know exactly what Hanuman represents or any of that lore, but also I kind of wondered when the sort of second round of fights we saw, he kept going against other creatures, you know, people dressed as other creatures. I was like, is this a story I should know? Is this significant? Is this not? Am I making it up in my mind? And so I was wondering if they were having fun with that, but I didn't know. I mean, I still enjoyed the fights, but it was an extra level where I was just kind of like left wondering if I was missing out. Hanuman is also a yoga pose.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like that goes back to just, I wish if the mysticism part was going to be like an ongoing theme, that it wasn't introduced to us halfway through. Right. Like,
yeah,
if this is going to be like a, you know, they don't have to go like super on the nose like RRR did. But like, I wish that stuff landed better for me. And I don't know if it's because I don't understand. Because, like, I mean, there's also like, you know, like people do Monkey King stuff all the time. And it's not like,
I think it's a different Monkey King.
It's a different Monkey King. And
but I'm saying, like, the Monkey King is a story that I understand. But the way Monkey King is deployed in like popular culture doesn't always follow Journey to the West, right?
Right. And so you're correct. Like, it doesn't have to become this really one-to-one interpretation or metaphor or any of those things. But I do in some way wonder if there's stuff I'm missing even in the context of the movie. But yeah, and I think there's a lot of tantalizing teases with all of these extra plot threads that I agree could have landed better. And so it made the second half of the movie kind of feel a little bit messy, even though there were definitely some satisfying things, such as the training sequence. I love a training sequence.
Love a training sequence. Thought the use of music was very cool.
Yes.
In that, and you know, like punching a rice bag, like how much more, like that's just very Asian, and I appreciate that. I kind of wish he like went a little more Rocky for, like, uh-huh, I want to see, uh-huh, I would have loved to see him like climbing trees or like, you know, like wheel, whatever the equivalent of like wheel, like we needed two more like site specific, building specific, environment specific training exercises, I think, to like really drive it home. And then I think they're, you know, like it was a pretty long movie, right? It's like a 2-hour movie.
Yeah,
I feel like there's some, like we talked about pacing, like there's some things I think we could have like spent as I think, as fun as I think the ring, like the wrestling ring, and as fun as that, you know, that weird white guy who shows up and like is just a douchebag. He's super fun character, but I was like, oh, like story wise, like those could have been like a series of montages, right? To like get us more time, maybe.
Yeah.
Deeper,
I mean, the film,
some of the more thematic questions.
I mean, the film really does get back on track when he goes back to storm the tower one more time.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And my question is, do these fuckers not have guns? Like, what? No one has a gun all of a sudden? Like, what?
Yeah. That was something I noticed, that there were a lot of blades. And sometimes they had a gun and they would get it out of the way really quickly. And I was like, okay.
I'm just like, wouldn't you pick up the gun that, like, someone dropped? If, you know, I mean, I guess he's not that well trained in the gun. You could, like, argue that. Mm-hmm. And again, it's hard to, you know, not be delighted by him using like a tea kettle, a microwave door, you know, like all these random things, or, you know, like a silver tray. It's all very, very thematic too, right? Using kind of the trappings of this luxury and exploitation to against your enemies. And, you know, like some other side characters get some really like agency filled, like come to Jesus, like revenge moments as well in this sequence. But I'm just like, I thought all you fuckers had guns before. I appreciate the fact that he's like, and this is where like my like producer film thing comes up. I like the, like, it's probably partially a call to John Wick, probably also a call to not have to have blood or makeup, mm-hmm, consistency, and you know, like all the henchmen are in black, so I'm like, okay, that's, it's nice to follow, like, in kind of this chaotic scene. And I was just like, I would love to hear, like, an account, maybe, like, a few years down the line of when he, you know, breaks down. He's like, oh, yeah, we had to do that because XYZ. Which he's talked a little about how he's had to pivot because of budget or, like, losing, like, film locations, losing XYZ. Mm-hmm. And I'd love to kind of figure out, like, what was intentional and what kind of was just a fate of chance.
Yeah. I mean, are we excited about if this will start the new Dev Patel action star era?
Oh, totally.
Yeah. I would actually love to see him directed by someone who, I mean, he did a phenomenal job for like a first time action director, but it would be really cool to see him, you know, directed by someone who has more like background in that.
Sure.
I mean, okay, here's a question for you.
Yeah.
Which action franchise do you want to see Dev Patel show up in? Do you want to see him in the Fast
every
film?
Single one.
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah. I want to see him in every, what's the most likely chance that we'll get him like shirtless again?
I mean, there's an obvious an option in any movie for him to be shirtless. You just have to write it in, I feel.
I think he'd just be the next John Wick. Like, they're making what, like two more, yeah, right? Like, yeah. I think he, because his body type, he's like a very slim build still, mm-hmm, even though he's, yeah, like, you know, that's very John in the John Wick mode.
Yes.
And
Fast franchise,
I mean,
yes.
I'll even take him in like a Megatron, whatever. It's fine. Like the shark, not the Megatron, the Jason Statham shark movie. The Meg.
Sure,
I'll take him in the Meg.
Okay, I was trying to.
Exactly,
it took me a while to figure out
really
what are you talking
people
about?
Up. I mean, they should just combine his, because we know he can play a gentleman. So, like, people always talk about Idris Elba being the next Bond. What if Dev Patel is the next Bond?
Bond would be great. You know what could also work? If you want to add some humor, is The Kingsman. That would work. Action with, with some nice suits.
That would be interesting take. And so here's my question. Like, it's to me, it's actually very interesting that Dev Patel decided to tell a story about an Indian character, mm-hmm. like in contemporary India. Mm-hmm. I wonder, like, and you know, there's some like controversy about this movie getting released in India. It hasn't been released in India. Because it's very political and, you know, they had to change the flags, even though it's like very obvious what the comp is to. And I'm just like, oh, like, I do wonder, like, as is he's worked in India, of course, his heritage is from there. But it is a little strange that someone like who grew up in England and works mainly in like Western movie systems decided to make a political action thriller movie set in India, being very critical of contemporary Indian politics. And I'm not the right person to talk about this. Just thought it would be like, oh, like what would be like, you know, it'd be like if, I don't know, like John Chu decided to make an action set movie about like the politics of Taiwan and China, like going, I was just like, oh, like, are you the right person to like dwell on this? I guess at the end of the day, it's more action than it is.
Yeah. Well,
you know, a deep commentary on. And
we also just, I mean, we don't know how deeply he feels about things, these things. So maybe he may not have the most, the deepest background on that type of stuff. But I was kind of still happy to see him give it a try. And maybe that's why we were feeling that things didn't go deep enough or have enough context or whatever. But I do hope this goes well because, yes, I would want to see him do more action, but also maybe his next effort could be like a totally different thing that might have more focus, maybe even a narrower focus. I think that's what I felt like I was lacking was like there were a few things that were kind of trying to be addressed. And so maybe that would be better because I think when we are talking about who's the right director for this in general, like even the action, even the other stuff, it's kind of like a lot of great, good first efforts, but cohesively not so much. So yeah, I'm curious, like what are his thoughts politically about a lot of things? and given time and nuance, what would he do or maybe even honing it? Because I think of that a lot of times when it comes to my younger writers is, you know, they come out of journalism school and they know how to do certain things, but they haven't explored the wealth of the types of stories they can do. And so when they're starting to try their hand at those, it's kind of like a little scary and they kind of, you know, don't know exactly how far they can push it. And so it might not be the best first expression of what they actually mean or think. And so this, I think this, that kind of can apply here. So like, yeah, he might not be seasoned enough to actually express what he wants to express.
You know, this all could have been avoided if he just made the bad guy Western imperialist.
Yeah. You know,
just, yeah, I feel like that would have been easier, right? Like
if it was easy colonialism.
Yeah. But, you know, maybe they're more expensive. Ooh.
Look, also, not everything can be an RRR, which is a little bit, you know, like you were saying, it's like easy to know who the bad guy is. They make did some over the top things.
I mean, let's be fair. The bad guys in a lot of contemporary, like the problems we see today in today's world are still white imperialists, right? They just look differently now. They wear suits and they work in corporations. But
yeah, that's true. They're the billionaires.
All right.
Thanks, well, Amazon.
Thanks, Amazon. Still paying for that free shipping. all right. Well, as we get closer to the end of our discussion, gotta ask the big question. Is Monkey Man good pop?
Yes. Original story. New filmmakers. New directors. Directors of color. More Dev Patel. Put Dev Patel in anything. Honestly, I would take Dev Patel like fitting in like 50%. I would take like a 40% good Dev Patel over almost 100% anyone else. So yes, more Dev Patel, please.
Yeah, I would also say good pop. It hits more than it misses for me. And I was actually very impressed by the things that did hit. So looking forward to more Dev Patel in whatever aspect he wants to show himself.
Yeah, I would also say good pop. I had a lot of fun. Was it a good film? It was okay, but was it a good action film? Definitely, yes. And yeah. Always love seeing people try new things. And again, yeah, I really hope this is the beginning of the Dev Patel action star era, because he's got the chops and he's willing to work hard. So I want to see him fight more people.
I just want to see more of him.
Yeah.
And for him to stare yearningly. We need more the Dev Patel rom-com.
Yeah.
When we get the official, like, Dev Patel rom-com, all is right with the world. All will be right with the world.
I mean, Dev Patel can do anything.
Yeah.
He really can. I mean, he's kind of proven that, no? Like, mm-hmm.
The David Copperfield.
He's done the period piece. Uh-huh. He's done the romance. He's done the drama. He's done the action.
He's done the weird indie film, yeah. Like Green Knight.
Whatever Green Knight was.
The fucking cum rag. Oh, my God.
It's amazing what he is able to be in a movie with and do, and it still works because it's him. So.
Yeah. All right, well, that'll do it for our discussion of Monkey Man on the Good Pop Culture Club. Before we go, Jess Han, if people want to find out more of your thoughts on the internet, where can they go?
My trash takes are on Twitter at JessJuTweets.
And I am everywhere at Hanonymous.
You can find me on the internet at Marvin Yue. You can find our show at goodpop.club. As always, we are a proud member of the Potluck Podcast Collective. You can check out our fellow Asian American hosted podcasts by going to the website podcastpotluck.com. Thank you so much for listening, and we'll see you all next time. Bye, everybody.
Bye.
Bye.
I'm Marvin.
And I'm Rira.
And we're the hosts of Books and Boba, a book club and podcast dedicated to books by Asian and Asian American authors.
Each month, we pick a book by an Asian author to read and discuss on the show.
We read a variety of genres, including contemporary and historical fiction, sci-fi and fantasy, romance and cozy mysteries, and so much more.
Our past book club picks have included Pachinko by Minjin Lee, Patron Saints of Nothing by Randy Ribeye, Grace of Kings by Ken Liu, and The Kiss Quotient by Helen Huang.
Every month, we also go through the latest news in Asian American literature, as well as chat with some awesome Asian authors about their works.
So whether you want to start reading for fun again or diversify your TBR list, we got your Asian literature cravings covered. For more info, check out our website at booksandboba.com, and you can listen to us on iTunes, Google Play, Spotify, and wherever you find your podcasts.
Part of the Potluck Podcast Collective.